And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
A perfectly good brain wasted.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We're on every day here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura County. We're on from 10 to 11 each day, leading into the lunch hour, followed by Susan Burrell, Living Your Inspired Life. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is People Who Matter. My goal is to bring you thought leaders in business and entertainment. My first guest, Stephen Johnson, is one of Newsweek's 50 people who matter the most on the internet. And we talked about where our good ideas come from. My next guest is a member of show business royalty. She's the daughter of Danny Thomas, who is, as you may remember, a famous comedian and pioneer of television. She is also a television pioneer in her own right. She had a groundbreaking show in the late 60s and early 70s. It was revolutionary for having a single working woman living alone in New York City. She's also a world-famous philanthropist. She's written a book. Her book is titled Growing Up Laughing, My Story and the Story of Funny. It's her memoir, and it also tells the role that comedy had in her life. If you want to call in and speak to Marla Thomas, you can call us at 639-0008. Her full name is Margaret Julia Marlo Thomas. She was born, well, I won't tell you when because I'm a gentleman, but she's an actress, a producer, and a social activist. Interesting how she got her name. The family called her Margot as she was growing up, but as a young girl, she had a little bit of a speech impediment, could not say Margot, ended up saying Marlo, and the name stuck from there. She's best known for her starring role on the TV series That Girl, which aired from 1966 to 1971. She also serves as the National Outreach Director for St. Jude's Children's Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee. She was born in Detroit, Michigan. She's the eldest child of comedian Danny Thomas and his wife, former Rosemarie Casaletti, both of whom have passed away. Marlo Thomas was raised in Beverly Hills, California. Her parents called her Margot as a child, but as I said, the speech impediment, name got changed to Marlo. Marlo graduated from the University of Southern California with a teaching degree. She began appearing as a regular on shows such as The Joey Bishop Show. She followed with a series of guest appearances on The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis, Ben Casey, My Favorite Martian, and, of course, Bonanza. In 1966, she won the role that she's best known for today, New York actress Anne Marie, on the ABC sitcom That Girl. The series ran until 1971. It garnered her a Golden Globe Award and four Emmy nominations. In 1973, Marlo joined Gloria Steinem, Patricia Carbine, and Letty Cotton, and they were the founders of the country's first women's fund, the Ms. Foundation for Women. Marlo is active with St. Jude's Research Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee, where she serves as the National Outreach Director. Marlo has been awarded four Emmys, as I said, a Golden Globe, a Grammy Award, and the George Foster Peabody Award. She's married to talk show host Phil Donahue. They were married in 1980, and she has five stepchildren from that arrangement. Marlo will be joining us from New York in just a minute. Her new book is titled Growing Up Laughing. Hello, Marlo. This is Billy the Brain. How are you?
Hi. How are you?
Well, I am terrific. Thank you so much for joining us all the way from New York.
My pleasure.
Oh, it's our pleasure to have you on board the show. I interview thought leaders in business, entertainment, sports, and our local community out here in Ventura, California. So you definitely fall into the category of thought leader in entertainment, coming from what I have dubbed a royal family of comedy. So you've done so much in your career, Marlo. I mean, it's amazing. But I want to start with That Girl.
Okay.
And talk about your television series. What made that show so remarkable in 1966 television, and what's the lasting effect on TV and on society in general?
Well, I don't know about all that. That sounds pretty heady stuff.
It is Billy the Brain, you know.
Yeah, that's right, of course. I think that, you know, there was something going on in the country, and we kind of wrote it in, you know. I mean, it was a lot happening. Gloria Steinem was in New York going undercover as a Playboy bunny and writing about that. Erica Young was writing Fear of Flying. Betty Friedan had written about 5 years before the Feminine Mystique. And I was in Los Angeles doing That Girl. So all of us were in different parts of the country, but we all had this feeling that we didn't want to be exactly who our mothers were, that we wanted more options. And so we were really a new breed of young females. And I think when That Girl went on the air, a lot of young girls felt exactly like I did and like Anne Marie did. And that was why, even though they were saying that she was a revolutionary figure, she really was a fait accompli. She was every in most every home in America. We got a 40 share that first night.
A 40 share. Now, today, I don't think a television show can get a 40
That's
share
not
anymore.
Possible.
Not
impossible.
Not even possible. That's a remarkable feat. How did you land the role of Anne-Marie?
Well, actually, I had done another series, another pilot called Tooth Company, and which I had to screen test for and go through all the aches and pains of aspiring actress. And I got that part, and it was a wonderful little comedy about a newlywed. I played a model. Paul Lynde was the model's photographer.
The great voice, yeah.
It was a cute show. Did it at Universal. And it didn't sell. But the head of the network and the head of Clairol saw it and called me in and said, we think you can be a television star.
Mm.
And we'd like to create a show for you. It was very, very fortunate. And so they sent me different ideas, different scripts, and I said to them, you know, everything you're sending me, the girl is either the daughter of somebody or the wife of somebody or the secretary of somebody. How about a show where the girl is a somebody? And like a girl like me who's graduated from college, whose parents want her to get married, she doesn't want to get married, she wants to be an actress. You know, what about that kind of show? And I remember Edgar Sherrick, who was head of the network at the time, said, would anybody watch a show like that? I said, well, I think they would. And so we got some writers and great writers, and we did the pilot. But even up to the night it went on, a lot had been written about, you know, the coming season, as they always do. And it was said that this show probably would not succeed because it had an unknown star, and the girl, you know, was living outside of a family unit. She wanted to be in show business, and all of those things did not fare well with audiences. They didn't care about show business stories. Or girls outside of family units, or a girl named Marlo Thomas, who no one knew who the heck that was. So it was a shock, really, that we did that well, and we hung on for 5 years and did very, very well. In fact,
yes,
they asked us to come on for 3 more years, and we just said, we've done every story. There's no more stories to do. So.
Oh, my. You were absolutely prescient in your knowing that that's what American audiences would want. We're talking to Marlo Thomas, everybody. I wanted to ask you about the name Anne-Marie for the title character there. Was that in any way a tribute to your mother, Rosemary?
No, actually, it was Bill Persky's name. He wanted to come up with a name that that I'd always have to explain that was my last name, because her name was Marie was her last name.
Mm-hmm.
Her dad was Lou Marie. So it was his idea that I have a name that was going to always be a problem. So that was his idea.
And that's how that came to be. All right, great. Now, you going into show business, your father probably had some advice for you about going into show business, may have even been a little bit reticent for you to go into show business. What did your dad, Danny Thomas, tell you about getting into show business, in particular comedy?
Well, he particularly told me not to go into show business. He didn't want me to be in it. He felt that it was a very tough job for a man and a woman, and he'd had 15 very tough, struggling years. And he said to me later, I just didn't want to go through that again with somebody that I loved. And I think that it really blurred his vision of my own dream. And he'd always been on my side all my life. And it was a shock that he was discouraging me now from doing what I wanted to do. But I wanted it so badly that he could not discourage me. And then once I got started and he saw that I really, you know, loved it, and that I, when he saw me in Barefoot in the Park in London, before that girl, he knew that I'd be okay, that I had what it took to do it, and then he gave me all kinds of wonderful advice about, you know, never lying to the audience in comedy, always staying, you know, true to your theme, and never just going for a laugh, and you know, you'd lose the audience if you weren't honest, and all of that really helped me when I was, you know, working on my own television series.
Oh, that is great. Now, obviously, you had the chops for television. You had the chops for comedy. Describe your father. In the book, you call him an old-fashioned dad.
Yes.
Tell us about your father and your relationship to your father.
Well, I mean, it was very, very close. My dad is unusual in the fact that he really enjoyed the company of his children. He liked to hang out with us. A lot of parents sort of, you know, have their children be seen and not heard, or they're kind of, you know, are anxious to get them out and have their adult evenings. My dad wasn't like that. He loved to have us around, and he loved to do things with us. And he took me to work with him. He just was an old-fashioned dad in the way that a kind of old-fashioned Norman Rockwell kind of families, you know. He wanted to hang out with his kids. He wanted to take his kids out to dinner. He wanted to go to the movies with us. He hung out with us a lot, and when his gang of guys, George Burns and Bob Hope and Sid Caesar and Milton Berle and all those guys came over to the house, he never shooed us out of the room. We always were welcome to sit there while they laughed and told jokes. It was, you know, it was a part of the family life, and I think that that made us all very close to each other and to him. And he was also a good listener. My dad always listened, and he never poo-pooed anything you said or said it was silly or don't worry about it. He really listened to what the complaint was. And I remember, in fact, I did a whole book called The Right Words at the Right Time based on the fact that he said words to me that changed my life. And that was when I was around 17 and I was doing a summer stock play, and all the reviewers and the interviewers were comparing me to him. Would I be as good as Danny Thomas? Would I last as long? Was I as funny? And I said, went to my dad, just teary-eyed, because I knew it would hurt his feelings. And I said, Daddy, I love you, but I don't want to be a Thomas anymore. I don't want to be judged by how I'm compared to you. I want to live and be judged on my own, and I want to change my name. And he said to me, I raise you to be a thoroughbred, and thoroughbreds run their own races. They don't look at any of the other horses. They just wear their blinders, and they run. And that's what you have to do. Don't look at me or anybody else. You just run your own race. Those are the best words I've ever been given by anybody.
That's great advice. We're talking to Marlo Thomas, everybody, talking about her latest book, Growing Up Laughing, My Story and the Story of Funny. And Marlo, as I read the book, one of the things that intrigued me was this juxtaposition of memoir with sort of the history of comedy and comedy roots. Now, it's an unusual mixture of the two subjects. How'd you come up with this idea for the book?
I didn't really think about it. I was only going to write my memoir. And when I started to write about my dad and his upbringing, which was pretty grim. I mean, his mom had 10 children kind of all in a row, so she was just exhausted all the time and running after 9 boys. And my grandfather was kind of a sourpuss in the best way to describe him, so there wasn't a lot of laughter in the house. But there was this one uncle that he had, Uncle Tony, who later was personified in the television series Make Room for Daddy as Uncle Tanoose. He was a very funny guy. In fact, he was so funny, my father said, he was barred from family funerals. They wouldn't even allow him to go. So Uncle Tony gave my dad the gift of laughter and, you know, laughed with him, joked with him, and gave him a sense of humor. So I was interested when I was writing that. I thought, that's so interesting. That's where he got his humor from, and I know where I got mine from him and all those comics that hung at our house. I wonder how Jerry Seinfeld found his funny, and Lily Tomlin and Chris Rock and all these wonderful comedians. Where did they get the funny? And so I started asking them, and at dinner parties or places where I saw them, and then some people that I didn't see, like Jon Stewart, that I absolutely called up and asked him, I found out that every single one of them had a funny member of their family, every one of them. And that just, you know, people say, is there a comedy gene? Well, there's definitely a comedy nutrient, you know, that you get nurtured with that in your house. Jerry Seinfeld's father had a joke file. You know, that's completely, you know, that's almost like growing up in my house. Jay Leno's father was an insurance salesman, and when he would go out on a call, he would try out jokes on little Jay. And Jay thought, gee, what a great job being an insurance salesman is. You get to tell jokes. So everybody, you know, had very funny people in their family.
Oh, that is great. That is a story. I want to come back and talk about some of those great comedians that you talked about. But first, I want to really start closer to home with your childhood when you were growing up with the people that surrounded your father that you euphemistically called the boys. And
right.
Just I wanted to get some top-of-the-mind reaction to some of these great comedians that hung around at your house. Sid Caesar.
Yeah. Oh, Sid was lovely. He still is lovely. He's one of the only ones of them still alive.
Mm.
Very, very sweet man and shy, and he always liked to do his comedy. You know, he would tell jokes always with an accent of a Russian or a Polish lieutenant or something, an Italian, but an adorable man.
Milton Berle.
Milton was hilarious. He was on from the moment he walked in the door. Nothing shy about Milton, complete opposite of Sid Caesar. He was just Mr. Rat-a-tat from the moment he walked in, always making everybody laugh and doing card tricks and, you know, just continuously on. on all the time. And I loved him. He was very, very funny. Funny to be with.
Carl Reiner?
Carl's another guy who's just wonderfully funny. And not rat-a-tat, not shy, but kind of in the middle somewhere. Just very funny and fun to be with. Very loving guy. Adored his wife, who's gone now, and he survived her. A great family man. He's a very swell guy, very normal man. I love him.
Very normal. That's a good thing to say about a person.
Yeah, yeah.
That is good. George Burns.
George Burns was my very favorite. He was always encouraging to me, always defended me when my dad would say I shouldn't be an actress. I remember one night at dinner, George said to my dad, what do you want her to be, a milliner? Like, there were only two options, a milliner or a actress. So I loved him. And he said to my dad, I feel sorry for anybody who isn't in show business. He really loved the field. He spent his, 40 years of his marriage with his wife, Gracie, and they were a great act. And he was a great straight man, but he was a darling, darling man.
Oh, that's good. What about Bob Hope?
Bob is a wonderful guy. He was so dear. You know, after my dad died, I write about it in the book, that my father used to always call all these guys up to help him raise money for St. Jude and do a show or come to a dinner or something. And after my father died, I got word that Bob was flying to New York from L.A., and he was older by then, to do a show, to do a dinner, to be the guest entertainment at a dinner in honor of my dad. And I called him, and I said, and to raise money for St. Jude, of course. And I called him, and I said, Bob, I'm just so touched that you would do this. I know all the years that Dad, would ask you to do stuff, but this is not Dad asking you, and I'm just very, very moved that you would do this. He said, are you kidding? I love Danny. So the friendship endured. Even he didn't say I loved him before. He said I love him now.
Yeah.
It was very much the love was in the present, and I was very moved by that. And that says a lot about who Bob Hope was.
Absolutely. We're talking to Marlo Thomas, everybody. Her book is Growing Up Laughing, My Story and the Story of Funny. Now, I want to ask you, looking back at the great comedians of the 60s, and now you've interviewed and made a science of really learning about comedy from current day comics, how is comedy different today than it was in the 1960s?
I think the biggest difference are the taboos are different. You know, in my dad's day, they didn't really say a lot of foul language, but they did make sexist jokes. And racist jokes and Polish jokes and all kinds of jokes about people that we don't do anymore. It's politically incorrect jokes. But people today don't do those, but they certainly swear and use all kinds of foul language. So I think the taboos have changed.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. Now, speaking of taboo breakers, you have interviewed all of the greats of modern comedy as well, and I just want to throw some more names out at you and get your impressions of them. And I'm going to start with Ben Stiller, because he grew up in a family, showbiz family like yourself. What are your impressions of Ben Stiller and comedy coming from his angle?
Well, I think Ben is a very confident guy and very adventurous. I mean, he does very brave things in his comedy, and I think that He does that because he grew up in a family of comedy and a family of a lot of love. His parents adored their children. Jerry Stiller and Ann Mira were wonderful parents. And I think that shows in Ben's confidence in himself. And I love the story that Jerry tells of how Ben would improv things in their living room and use their parents as foils for their comedy when they were kids. I mean, that's a loving family. That's the kind of family we had. And I think that's given him a lot of confidence and a lot of courage.
Ah, that's great. Now, what about Billy Crystal? You interviewed him for the book.
I did. I love Billy Crystal. He's another guy who grew up in a very loving family. He had a large family. His father and his Uncle Burns really encouraged him, encouraged his comedy. They saw his gift early on. They bought him props. They brought in things for him to play, so that he could even do more with his little comedy routines as a kid. His dad brought home comedy records from the Commodore bookstore, record store that he had. Billy liked to impersonate Yul Brynner, who was bald, as we know, and his father brought him home a bald cap to wear. I mean, they really encouraged him, and I think that, as I say in my book, I think that's why Billy is so warm and at such ease. There's no anger in Billy Crystal's comedy. He's very at ease and very full of love.
We're talking to Marlo Thomas, everybody, getting her impressions of famous comedians that she has interviewed for her latest book. And I'm going to turn to one of my favorites, Robin Williams.
I love Robin. Well, you know, he does a lot of work for St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, so he has a special place in my heart. He's part of my Thanks and Giving program. And he's like a kid. He just loves to laugh and loves to make people laugh. You know, his mother, as I write about in the book, she used to put a rubber band up her nose, and when his friends would come over, she'd let it drop out. Now, that crazy kind of thing, you know, that she was so funny and so adorable. He's got that adorableness and that wildness, but, you know, he sees humor everywhere. He's a very funny guy. I love having him around because he doesn't stop. He's very funny.
Very talented. On from the moment you meet him, isn't he?
I know, yeah.
That's great. All right, let's turn our attention to some of the female comedians. Kathy Griffin.
Kathy's another one who had a very funny father. And she said he kind of had a Don Rickles thing where he could put people down in a funny way, and everybody loved him anyway. They loved him for it. And she said she has a little bit of that Don Rickles thing that she thinks she got from her dad. So I thought that was interesting that she was able, you know, that she picked that up from him.
Hmm.
And she's, because she's outrageous. I mean, she'll say anything. And I think she says it's because her dad did.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
Joan Rivers.
Joan is interesting because she had her father was a doctor, and he was very funny. She said he always had jokes for the patients and stories that he told that were funny about his patients. But she had a very tough start. She couldn't get started. Nobody believed in her. Her parents did not want her to be a comedian. They didn't mind her being a comedy writer, but not a comedian. And she had a hard time getting started. People, you know, just didn't give her a break. So she had a tough 15 years. So she came on with a lot to show people, a lot to prove. And she still is one of the hardest working people I know in comedy. She told me that she goes every Wednesday night to a comedy club in New York, downtown New York, just to work on the act.
Wow.
The only thing different is my tape recorder is smaller. I've been doing that all my career.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, she's very, very dedicated to the craft of comedy. That's what I loved showing in my book, is how all of these people, the older guys and the new guys and women, are very much into the craft, into honing it and making it better, into finding out, you know, how do you put a good act together. It's not anything accidental. People don't get up there and just make a few jokes. They've really worked that over. Chris Rock said to do a HBO special, he does that show about 30 times in a nightclub.
Wow. All right, let me ask you, we're talking to Marlo Thomas, everybody, her book, Growing Up Laughing, My Story and the Story of Funny. Let me ask you about an honorary member of the boys that hung around with your father, Phyllis Diller.
Yeah, she was funny. She was the only one in those days, you know, before Joan Rivers and Lily and Whoopi and Joy Behar and all of them. There really weren't a lot of women. Lucille Ball was funny, but she wasn't a stand-up. Phyllis was really the only female stand-up that hung out with them. And she was wonderfully funny, and she loved to laugh, as you know. And she would hang out with them and contribute and laugh. She was a good audience.
Oh, absolutely. We're talking to Marlo Thomas, everybody. And Marlo, I'm going to change gears on you right now, and I want to talk a little bit about St. Jude's Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee. It's
sure.
Such a big part of the Thomas family legacy. Tell us a little bit about it. How and why did your father start it? Why did you continue in his footsteps? And what's your role as the National Outreach Director?
Well, a lot of people know that my father started it because he grew up very poor. He never went to a doctor. He never went to a dentist. My dad had false teeth.
Hmm.
Never went to a dentist. Neither did any of his 9 siblings. And children in his neighborhood died of influenza and rodent bites. And he just knew that it was unfair and that every child should have a birthright to good health care. And he wanted to do something about that. So that was always in his conscience. And he put it in the South because he read somewhere that a little boy, a little black kid, 8 years old, was hit on his bike in Mississippi, and because no emergency room would take him, he died, and my dad decided he put the hospital in the South. So there was a lot of emotion in where it went and what it was about, and it's a wonderful place. It's a place that, you know, has research and science as well as treatment under one roof, and that's why we've been able to make such fabulous scientific discoveries with international people all over the country, all over the world who come to study there and to do their best scientific work there. And no child is ever turned away if a family can't pay. And that's another thing that came right out of my father's childhood. the fact that every child should have the right to first-class care and a chance at great research. And so that's the dream that I'm keeping alive as National Outreach Director. We have to raise $700 million a year because it's free. It costs $1.5 a day to run because we have great scientists and we have a great treatment center. I don't know if you know, but this year St. Jude was named the number one pediatric cancer institute in the country by the U.S. News and World Report.
Congratulations.
Yeah, and the Harris Poll named us the number one most trusted charity in America. And we work hard. We work very hard for those accolades and all the people that work at St. Jude. I'm just a lowly fundraiser.
Oh, I think that's a bit of an understatement on your part. You do your part.
The people at St. Jude deserve it.
Yeah.
They're good people, honorable people.
And Marlo, if people wanted to learn more about St. Jude's, where would you direct them?
To stjude.org.
stjude.org.
And if people want to get in touch with me, please come to marlothomas.com. I'm now on AOL on my own website at marlothomas.com and join the conversation. We're having a lot of fun. I'm also on Facebook and Twitter.
Oh, that's great, Marlo. We've been talking to Marlo Thomas, everybody. Her latest book is Growing Up Laughing, My Story and the Story of Funny. Marlo, thank you so much for being our special guest today. We'll talk to you down the road.
I enjoyed it so much. Thank you.
Talk to you soon.